To put it into perspective, this international monetary system based around centrally managed fiat currency is only 16 years older than me. My father was 36 when the US went off the gold standard. When I grew up, after a period of financial hardship, I began collecting gold and silver coins as a kid. My father gave me silver coins as savings each year. The Swiss dropped their gold standard when I was 12 years old, which was 6 years after Amazon was founded and 3 years before Tesla was founded. The fiat petrodollar standard is only 4 times older than Bitcoin, and only 2 times older than the first internet browser. That's pretty recent when you think about it like that. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the show. This is Bitcoin Audible, and I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. We are continuing Lynn Alden's amazing piece, What is Money Anyway?, with the section on fiat currency. This is a longer section, but it is amazing. And I have tons of notes and stuff from this one, which we will cover later. But man, this is just packed with solid stuff. If you don't know the history, this is such a great condensing of so many fundamental elements about fiat currency that are either misunderstood or just hard to recognize when you're in it. Like, to step back, you know, I think I've always felt like to take a step back and kind of take an alien's view of the world and how things work is the only way to get an honest approach of it, because we just think because we're in this fiat system, it makes sense and it's perfectly normal and governments just have fiat currencies, when in reality, this is completely unprecedented. This is a totally experimental time in the context of monetary history, and we do not really understand the degree of fallout that the experiment that we are undergoing truly will experience. And in that context, we allow ourselves to take for granted the way it works. And Lynn Alden does such a good job of just laying out all of the pieces of the puzzle so you can see a clear picture of something that's hard to see because we're always standing so close to it. So let's go ahead and get into the read. Really quick, I just want to thank our sponsors, the Fold Card, 20% off with code Bitcoin Audible. I got 3 bills coming in today, rather large ones, and I spun 2% on all 3 of them. Seriously, Fold is the way to do fiat because you get sats on freaking everything. If you're missing out, I feel so sorry for you. But you can always make it up to yourself by stacking sats with Swan Bitcoin. Make sure you have a ongoing savings account that buys every, day, week, month, paycheck, whatever. And obviously, you've got access to the best team, a no-nonsense, one of the best educational resources in the space that's not going to push trading or shitcoins on you. They know what Bitcoin is. Go to swanbitcoin.com/guy, and then you're going to want to withdraw that Bitcoin to your solid Bitcoin-only hardware wallet. Snag yourself a cold card. They will probably be sponsoring the show soon. Okay, guys, let's jump right into the read. Part 2 of What is Money Anyway? By Lynn Alden, with the section titled Fiat Currency. Historically, a number of cultures have attempted periods of paper currency, issued by the government and backed by nothing. Often, it was the result of currency that was once backed, a gold standard or silver standard, but the government created too much of the paper due to war or other issues, and had to default on the metal backing by eliminating its ability to be converted back into the metal upon request. In that sense, currency devaluation becomes a form of tax and/or wealth confiscation. The public holds their savings in the paper currency and then the rug is pulled out from under them. The general argument for why fiat currencies exist is that most governments, if possible, do not want to be constrained by gold or other scarce monies, and instead want to have more flexibility with their spending. The earliest identified use of paper currency was in China over 1,000 years ago, which makes sense considering that paper was invented in that region. They eventually shifted towards government monopoly on paper currency, and combined with an elimination of its ability to be converted back into silver, resulted in the first fiat currency, along with the inflation that comes with that. It didn't last very long. Fiat currency is interesting because, unlike the history of commodity money, it's a step down in terms of scarcity. Gold beat out all of the other commodity monies over centuries of globalization and technological development, and then gold itself was defeated by pieces of paper? This is generally attributed to technology and government power. As clans became kingdoms, and as kingdoms became nation-states, along with the creation of banking systems and improvements in communication systems, governments could become a larger part of everyday life. Once gold became sufficiently centralized in the vaults of banks and central banks, and paper claims were issued against it, the only remaining step was to end the redeemability of that paper and enforce its continued usage through legal obligation. Debasing currency and empowering wars. Currency debasement often happened gradually under metallic and bimetallic currency regimes, with history of it going back 3,000 or 4,000 years. It took the form of reducing the amount of the valuable metal, such as gold or silver, and either adding base metal or putting decorative holes through the center of it to reduce the weight. In other words, a ruler often found himself faced with budget deficits and having to make the difficult choice between cutting spending or raising taxes. Finding both to be politically challenging, he would sometimes resort to keeping taxes the same, diluting the content of gold or silver in the coins, and spending more coins with less precious metal in each coin, while expecting it to still be treated with the same purchasing power per coin. For example, a king can collect 1,000 gold coins in taxes, melt them down and make new coins that are each 90% gold, with the other 10% made from some cheap filler metal, and spend 1,111 gold coins back into the economy with the same amount of gold. They do look pretty similar to most people, but some discerning people will notice. Years later, if that's not enough, he could remelt them and make them 80% gold, and spend 1,250 of them into the economy. At first, these slightly debased coins would be treated as how they were before. But as the coins are increasingly debased, it would become obvious. People's savings would decline in value, as they found over time that their stash of gold and silver was only fractional gold and silver. Foreign merchants in particular would be quick to demand more of these debased gold coins in exchange for their goods and services. Gold-backed paper currencies and fiat currencies are the modern version of that, and so the debasement can happen much faster. At first, fiat currencies were created temporarily in times of war. After the shift from commodity money to gold-backed paper, the gold backing would be briefly suspended as an emergency action for a number of years, and then reinstated, usually with a significant devaluation, to a lower amount of gold per unit of currency, since a lot of currency was issued during the emergency period. This is a faster and more efficient way to devalue a currency than to actually debase the metal. The government doesn't have to collect everyone's coins and remelt them. Instead, everybody is holding paper money that they trust to be redeemable for a certain amount of gold, and the government can break that trust, suspend that redeemability, print a ton of paper money, and then re-peg that paper money such that each unit of paper currency is redeemable for a much smaller amount of gold, before people realize what is happening to their savings. That method instantly debases people's money while they continue to hold it, and can be done overnight with the stroke of a pen. Throughout the 20th century, this tactic spread around the world like a virus. Prior to paper currencies, governments would run out of fighting capability if they ran low on gold. Governments would use up their gold reserves and raise additional war taxes. There were limits in terms of how much gold they had and how much they could realistically tax for unpopular wars before the population would rebel. However, by having all of their citizens on a gold-backed paper currency, they could devalue everyone's savings for the war without an official tax by printing a lot of money, spending it into the economy, and then eliminating or reducing the gold peg before people knew what was happening to their money. This allowed governments to fight much larger wars by extracting more savings from their citizens, which led their international opponents to debase their currencies with similar tactics as well, if they wanted to win. Ironically, the fact that fiat currencies have no cost to produce is what gave them the biggest cost of all. Bretton Woods and the petrodollar. After World War I and throughout the tariff wars and World War II period thereafter, many countries went off the gold standard or devalued their currencies relative to gold. John Maynard Keynes, the famous economist, said in 1924, quote, "In truth, the gold standard is already a barbarous relic." By 1934, gold was made illegal to own. It was punishable by up to 10 years in prison for Americans to own it. The dollar was no longer redeemable for gold by American citizens, although it was still redeemable for official foreign creditors, which was an important part of maintaining the dollar's credibility. Shortly after Americans were forced to sell their gold to the government in exchange for dollars, the dollar was devalued relative to gold, which benefited the government at the expense of those who were forced to sell it. It remained illegal for Americans to own gold for about 4 decades, until the mid-1970s. Interestingly enough, that overlapped quite cleanly with the period where U.S. treasuries underperformed inflation. Basically, the main release valve that people could turn to instead of cash or treasuries as savings assets was made illegal to them. It's rather ironic. Gold was a, quote, barbarous relic, and yet apparently had to be confiscated and pushed out of use by the threat of imprisonment and hoarded only by the government during a period of intentional currency devaluation. If it were truly such a relic, it would have fallen out of usage on its own, and the government would have had little need to own any. Making gold illegal to own was hard to enforce, though. There were not many prosecutions for it, and it's not as though authorities went door to door looking for it. By 1944, towards the end of World War II, after most currencies were sharply devalued, the Bretton Woods Agreement was reached. Most countries pegged their currency to the dollar, and the United States dollar remained pegged to gold, but only redeemable to large foreign creditors, not American citizens. By extension, a pseudo-gold standard was temporarily reestablished. This lasted only 27 years until 1971, when the United States no longer had enough gold to maintain redemption for its dollars, and thus ended the gold standard for itself and most of the world. There were too many dollar claims compared to how much gold the U.S. had. The Bretton Woods system was poorly constructed from the beginning, because domestic and foreign banks could lend dollars into existence without having to maintain a certain amount of gold to back those dollars. The mechanism for dollar creation and gold were completely decoupled from each other, in other words. And so it was inevitable that the quantity of dollars in existence would quickly outpace how much gold the U.S. Treasury had in its vaults. As the amount of dollars multiplied and the amount of available gold did not, any smart foreign creditor would begin redeeming dollars for gold and draining the Treasury's vaults. The Treasury would be quickly drained of its gold until they either sharply devalued the dollar peg or ended the peg altogether, which they did. Since that time, over 50 years now, virtually all countries in the world have been on a fiat currency system, which is the first time in history this has happened. Switzerland was an exception that kept their gold standard until 1999, but for most countries, It has been over 50 years since they were on it. However, the US dollar still has a vestige of commodity backing, which is part of what kept this system together for so long. In the 1970s, the US made a deal with Saudi Arabia and other OPEC countries to only sell their oil in dollars, regardless of which country was buying. In return, the US would provide military protection and trade deals, and thus, the petrodollar system was born. We've had to deal with the consequences of this awkward relationship ever since. While the dollar was not pegged to any specific price of oil in this system, this petrodollar system made it so that any country in the world that needed to import oil needed dollars to do so. Thus, universal demand for dollars was established, as long as the US had enough military might and influence in the Middle East to maintain the agreement with the oil-exporting nations. Other countries continued to issue their own currencies, but held gold, dollars, mainly in the form of US treasuries, and other foreign currency assets as reserves to back up their currencies. Most of their currencies were not pegged to any specific dollar, oil, or gold value during this time, but having a large reserve that they could use to actively maintain the strength of their currency was a key part of why global creditors would accept their currency. The biggest benefit from the petrodollar system, as analyst Luke Grauman has argued, is that it contributed to the US's Cold War victory over the Soviet Union during the 1970s and 1980s. The petrodollar agreement and associated military buildup to enforce it was a strong chess move by the US to gain influence over the Middle East and its resources. However, Grauman also argues that when the Soviet Union fell in the early 1990s, the US should have pivoted and given up this system to avoid ongoing structural trade deficits, but did not, and so its industrial base was aggressively hollowed out. Since then, China and other countries have used the system against the US, and the US also bled out tremendous resources trying to maintain its hegemony in the Middle East with its wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. An international gold standard looks like this, with each major country pegging its own currency to a fixed amount of gold and holding gold in reserve, for which it was redeemable to its citizens and foreign creditors. The Bretton Woods pseudo-gold standard involved the dollar being backed by gold, but only redeemable to foreign creditors in limited amounts. Foreign currencies pegged themselves to the dollar and held dollars or treasuries and gold in reserve. The petrodollar system made it so that only dollars could buy oil imports around the world, and so countries globally hold a combination of dollars, gold, and other major currencies as reserves with an emphasis on dollars. If countries want to strengthen their currencies, they can sell some reserves and buy back their own currency. If countries want to weaken their currencies, they can print more of their currency and buy more reserve assets. Over time, that demand for dollars was broadened via trade in debt. If two countries trade goods or services, they often do so in dollars. When loans are made internationally, they are often done so in dollars. And the world now has over $13 trillion in dollar-denominated debt, owed to all sorts of places, including lenders in Europe and China. All of that dollar-denominated debt represents additional demand for dollars, since dollars are required to service that debt. Basically, the petrodollar deal helped initiate and maintain the network effect at a critical time, until it became rather self-sustaining. This system gives the United States considerable geopolitical influence, because it can sanction any country and cut it off from the dollar-based system. One of the key flaws of the petrodollar system, however, is that all of this demand for the dollar makes US exports more expensive or less competitive, and makes imports less expensive. And so the US began running structural trade deficits once we established the system, totaling over $14 trillion in cumulative deficits as of this writing. From 1944 to 1971, the US drew down its gold reserves in order to maintain the Bretton Woods dollar system. Whereas from 1974 to present, the US instead drew down its industrial base to maintain the petrodollar system. As the FT described in a clever article back in 2019, this petrodollar system ironically gave the United States a form of Dutch disease. For those who aren't familiar with the term, Investopedia has a good article on Dutch disease. Here's a summary. Quote, the term Dutch disease was coined by The Economist magazine in 1977 when the publication analyzed a crisis that occurred in the Netherlands after the discovery of vast natural gas deposits in the North Sea in 1959. The newfound wealth and massive exports of oil caused the value of the Dutch guilder to rise sharply, making Dutch exports of all non-oil products less competitive on the world market. Unemployment rose from 1.1% to 5.1%, and capital investment in the country dropped. Dutch disease became widely used in economic circles as a shorthand way of describing the paradoxical situation in which seemingly good news, such as the discovery of large oil reserves, negatively impacts a country's broader economy. As the FT argues, correctly in my view, making virtually all global oil priced in dollars basically gave the United States a form of Dutch disease. Except instead of finding oil or gas, we engineered a system so that every country needs dollars, and so we need to export a lot of dollars via a structural trade deficit. And thus, the dollar as a global reserve asset basically served the role of a big oil and gas discovery. The system, much like the Netherlands' natural gas discovery, kept the U.S. currency persistently stronger at any given time than it should be on a trade balance basis. This made actual U.S. exports rather uncompetitive, boosted our import power, especially for the upper classes, and prevented the U.S. balance of trade from ever normalizing for decades. Japan and Germany became major exporters at our expense, and for example, their auto industries thrived globally, while the U.S. auto industry faltered and led to the creation of the Rust Belt across the Midwestern and Northeast part of the country. And then China grew and did the same thing to the United States over the past 20 years. They ate our manufacturing lunch. Meanwhile, Taiwan and South Korea became the hubs of the global semiconductor market, rather than the United States. That petrodollar system is starting to crack under its own weight, as trade deficits have collected into a massively negative net international investment position for the U.S., and the U.S. has more wealth concentration than the rest of the developed world because we hollowed out a lot of our blue-collar workforce specifically. This causes rising political tensions and desires, so far unsuccessful, to reduce the trade deficit and rebuild our industrial base. Foreigners take their persistent dollar surpluses and buy productive U.S. assets with them, like stocks, real estate, and land. In other words, the U.S. sells its appreciating financial assets in exchange for depreciating consumer goods. Potential post-petrodollar designs. Okay, let's pause right here, and I want to thank the Fold Card. Because like I said at the beginning of this show, I had some bills come in today, and I got 2% back on each one. Now understand, I don't do anything different. I spend and use the debit card like I would use any debit card, except that I get sats back on everything that I purchase. So a normie with an old, regular debit card and bank account, they don't get anything. They just spend fiat on their monthly bills, and they get nothing. They don't get sats. They buy stuff on Amazon, and that's it. The money just goes. They don't earn any Bitcoin. I get 5% back because you can get Fold gift cards plus a spin on the Wheel of Awesomeness. Literally, sometimes I get like 7%, 8% back on Amazon, which is ridiculous. In fact, between recording the beginning of this show and now, my cell phone bill came in, and on my third spin, I got 4% back. So it was a $131 bill, and it just netted me 23,636 sats in my stack. Snag your card with a 20% discount off the annual price with code BITCOINAUDIBLE. Go to guyswan.com/fold. The link and other details will be right in the show notes. 20% is a great discount for you guys, so don't forget it. And also, actually, use my link because they actually have this really awesome thing called the Spin Squad. So you're literally actually supporting the show. If you use my link, my referral link, I actually get like a tiny portion of the sats that you get in rewards. So like the other people, like my family and stuff that I've signed up, like I just get like look at this, I've just got 10 sats, 22 sats, 9 sats, 48 sats, 17 sats, like just from them swiping their card. So that's actually a really great way to support the show as well. So thank you for everybody who has done that. GuySwan.com/fold. Okay, let's jump back in. Potential post-petrodollar designs. There are proposals by policymakers and analysts to rebalance the global payment system, and the changing nature of geopolitics is pointing in that direction as well. For example, Russia began pricing its oil partly in euros over the past few years, and China has put considerable work into launching a digital currency that may expand their global reach, at least with some of their most dependent trade partners. The United States is no longer the biggest commodity importer, and its share of global GDP continues to decrease, which makes the existing petrodollar system less tenable. If several large fiat currencies can be used to buy oil, then the model looks more like this. And many tertiary currencies would manage themselves relative to these main currencies that have the scale and influence to buy oil and other foreign goods. If a major scarce natural reserve asset, for example gold or Bitcoin or digital SDRs or something along these lines, depending on your conception of what trends are going over the next decade or two, is used as a globally recognized form of money, then a decentralized model can also look like this. Overall, it's clear that the trend in global payments is toward digitization and decentralization, away from one single country's currency. But it's unclear precisely how the next system will turn out and on what timeline it will change. It continues to be a subject that I analyze closely for news and data. Price inflation from a negative baseline. The long arc of human history is deflationary. As our technology improves over time, we become more productive, which reduces the labor and resource cost of most goods and services. This is particularly true over the past couple of centuries as humanity exponentially tapped into dense forms of energy. Prior to that, our rate of productivity growth was much slower. For an example of productivity, people used to farm by hand. By harnessing the utility of workhorses and simple equipment, it empowered one person to do the work of several people. Then the invention of the tractor and similar advanced equipment empowered one person to do the work of 10 or more people. As tractor technology got bigger and better, this figure probably jumped to 30 or more people, and then we can imagine a fleet of self-driving farming equipment allowing one person to do the work of 100 people. As a result, a smaller and smaller percentage of the population needs to work in agriculture in order to feed the whole population. This makes food less expensive and frees up everyone else for other productive pursuits. Gold has historically appreciated against most other commodities over time, like an upward sine wave. Alternatively, we can say that most commodities depreciated in price against gold, like a downward sine wave. For example, there are inflationary cycles where copper increases in price compared to gold, but over multiple decades of cycles, gold has steadily appreciated against copper. For agricultural commodities that are less scarce, the trend is even stronger. Here's a chart of the copper to gold ratio showing its structural decline and cyclical exceptions since 1850, for example. And here's wheat priced in gold since 1910. This is because, over time, our advancing technology has made us more efficient at harvesting those other commodities. However, gold's extreme scarcity and rather strict stock-to-flow ratio of over 50x has made it so that our technology advancements in finding and mining gold are offset by the fact that we've already mined the, quote, easy gold deposits, and the remaining deposits are getting deeper and harder. We never truly get more efficient at retrieving gold in that sense. It's a built-in, ongoing difficulty adjustment. During the late 1800s and early 1900s USA, which is when the country became a rising power globally, the country was on a gold standard and in a period of structural deflation. prices of most things went down because land was abundant, and huge advancements in technology during the Industrial Age made people far more productive. An even more extreme example would be television prices over the past 5 decades. Moore's Law, industrial automation, and labor offshoring has made televisions exponentially better and cheaper over time, especially when priced in gold. Similarly, cell phones decades ago were very large, basic, and expensive toys for the wealthy. Now, many people in the poorest regions of the world have powerful smartphones as a normal course of life. They have supercomputers in their pockets. Overall, we can say that the baseline inflation rate is some negative number, aka deflation, and how negative it is at any given time depends on the pace of technological advancement. Baseline inflation only becomes a positive number if we are backtracking in some way, and thus encountering more scarcity and less abundance. This could be due to malinvestment or war, for example. By holding the most saleable good, such as gold historically, your purchasing power gradually appreciates over time because the labor and resource cost of most other things goes down, whereas that saleable good retains most or all of its scarcity and value. The vast majority of commodities, products, and services structurally decrease in price gradually relative to your strong store of value. One way to measure this is by looking at the broad money supply per capita over time relative to the Consumer Price Index. Here's a chart of their 5-year rolling average growth rates for the United Kingdom. We can see that there is usually a positive gap between broad money supply growth per capita and consumer prices. Broad money supply per capita increased by an average of 5.3% per year during this 150-plus year period, while a basket of goods and services increased by an average of only 3.1%. In other words, monetary inflation is usually a bit faster than price inflation. In a very rough sense, by this way of looking at it, real productivity growth was about 2.2% per year, which is the difference between these figures. What this means is that in any given year, the resource and labor costs of a broad basket of goods and services goes down by an average of 2.2% due to technological progress, but the amount of money that people have goes up by 5.3%, and as such, actual prices go up by only 3.1%. So, price inflation is not 3.1% from a baseline of zero. It's 5.3% from a baseline of negative 2.2%. Actual resource costs for goods and services go down most years rather than stay flat. But due to our inflationary monetary framework, they go up in price anyway. The reason this is only a rough measure is because, one, the CPI basket changes over time and may not be fully representative, and two, the money supply can become more concentrated or less concentrated over time, and thus does not always reflect the buying power of the median person. There is no way to directly measure technological deflation. It can only be estimated. Another way to check this is to simply see to what extent gold appreciated in price against the British pound. And the answer is about 4% per year over this same 150-year time period. Gold appreciated in price faster than the CPI basket inflation rate by about 0.9% per year, the difference between 4% and 3.1%, which compounds quite a bit over a century, and can buy you a bit more copper, oil, wheat, or many other goods and services than it could 50, 100, or 150 years ago, unlike the British pound, which buys you a lot less than it used to. Higher quality and scarcer goods like meat have roughly kept up with the price of gold, although you can't store meat for very long, and select few assets like the absolute best or scarcest UK property locations may have appreciated a bit faster than gold, although they required continued maintenance costs along the way, which makes up for that difference. The takeaway from this section is that the growth in the broad money supply per capita is the true inflation rate, However, the baseline that we measure it against is not zero. It's a mildly negative number which we can't precisely measure, but that we can estimate and infer. It represents ongoing increases in productivity due to technology. Prices of most things stay relatively stable or preferably keep going down as priced in the most saleable good, such as gold historically, over the long run, but go up in most years when measured in a depreciating and weaker unit of account, such as the British pound. The MMT description of fiat currency. Some economists disagree with the commodity view of money and argue that money originates with the government. This is called chartalism, and its origins go back more than a century. Decades ago, Warren Mosler and others resurfaced this idea into what is now popularly known as modern monetary theory, or MMT. I have often felt that Mosler describes the case for that school of thought well. He doesn't sugarcoat things, and instead speaks very directly. Quote, start with the government trying to provision itself, and how does it do it? There are different ways to do it throughout history. One way is to just go out and take slaves. Another way the British did is they provisioned their navy by going to bars late at night and dragging them onto ships. It's called impressing sailors. We pretend to be more civilized, as I like to say, and we use a monetary system. So how does a government do it? Clean sheet of paper, what you do is you establish a tax that is payable in something that people don't have. So what you want to do is transfer resources from the private sector to the public sector. You want people who are out there doing whatever they are doing to suddenly be working for the government. You need soldiers, you need police, you need health workers, you need people in education. How do you get these people out of the private sector and into the public sector? First thing you do is levy a tax. You need a tax liability, and it has to be coercive. And for this example, I'll use a property tax. You put a tax on everybody's house, and you make it payable in your new unit of account. Your new unit, your thing, your tax credit, the thing that is used to pay the tax. The dollar, the yen, or the euro, they are all tax credits. What has happened is you've created sellers of real goods and services who now need your tax credit, or they're going to lose their house. You've created unemployment, people looking for paid work. Unemployment is not about people looking to volunteer at the American Cancer Society. It's about people looking for work because they need or want the money. And the problem with government when you want to provision yourself is that there's no unemployment. No unemployment in terms of your currency. There may be people willing to work for other things, but not for your currency. You need unemployment in terms of your currency, looking to earn your unit of account. So you levy a tax. Now people need your unit of account. All of these people show up looking for work. All of those people are unemployed. You now hire the unemployed that your tax created, and they are now provisioning your government. Warren Mosler, from the 2017 MMT Conference. I also liked this description, where he explained his view in an economic debate. Quote, the way we do it is we slap on a tax for something that nobody has, and in order to get the funds to pay that tax, you have to come to the government for it. And so that way, the government can spend its otherwise worthless currency and provision itself. Now, the way I like to explain that is I'll take out my business card here. Now, I ask this room, does anybody want to buy, and this is called How to Turn Litter into Money, does anybody want to buy one of these cards for $100? No? Okay. Does anyone want to stay after hours and help vacuum the floor and clean the room and I'll give you my cards? No? All right. Oh, by the way, there's only one door out of here and my guy is out there with a 9mm and you can't get out of here without one of these cards. Can you feel the pressure now? You're now unemployed. In terms of my cards, you were not unemployed before. You were not looking for a job that paid in my cards. Now you're looking for a job that pays in my cards, or you're looking to buy them from someone else that will take a job that pays in my cards. The difference between money and litter is whether there's a tax man outside the door. The guy with the 9mm is the tax man. If he can't enforce tax collection, the value of the dollar goes to zero. Warren Mosler from the 2013 MMT versus Austrian debate. Nobel laureate economist Paul Krugman put it rather similarly back in 2013. Quote, "Fiat money, if you like, is backed by men with guns." Of course, we could just as easily ask, since the government is using force to collect taxes to provision itself, why can't it just collect commodity money like gold with a tax, and then spend that gold to acquire its necessary provisions? Why does it need to issue its own paper currency and then tax it back? The answer is that it doesn't have to, but it wants to. By issuing its own currency, it profits from seigniorage, which is the difference between the face value of the money and the cost to produce and distribute it. It is basically a subtle inflation tax that compounds over time. A weak government, with an economy that can't provision most of its needs, often fails to maintain a workable fiat currency for very long. People start using alternative monies, out of necessity, even if the government supposedly disallows them from doing so. This happens to many developing countries. Billions of people in the world today have experienced the effects of hyperinflation or near hyperinflation within the past generation. It's unfortunately quite common. However, developed countries have been more successful at maintaining seigniorage over the past 5 decades of the fiat system. Their currencies all lost 95 to 99% of their purchasing power over time, but it was usually gradual rather than abrupt. The system is not without its cracks, as previously discussed, but it's certainly the most comprehensive fiat currency system ever constructed. When optimized skillfully, a fiat currency has low volatility year to year in exchange for gradually losing value over the long run. By being actively managed with taxes, spending, and central bank reserve management, creating or destroying currency in exchange for reserve assets, policymakers try to maintain a low and steady inflation rate, meaning a mild and persistent decline in the purchasing power of their currency. A strong government can force the use of its currency over all other types of monies within its borders, at least for a medium of exchange, not necessarily a store of value, by taxing other types of transactions, and by only accepting its fiat currency as a form of payment for taxes. They can make things like gold, silver, and Bitcoin less convenient as money, for example, by making each transaction with it a taxable event in terms of capital gains. If push comes to shove, they can also try to ban those things with the threat of force. The monetization of other assets. This section is great, but let's pause right here before we get into it and have another word from our sponsor. You know, there's this saying that everybody has to painfully wade through the valley of shitcoins to ultimately find their way back to Bitcoin, but I don't think it's true. If you send people to Swan Bitcoin, you won't get shilled garbage like on Coinbase or other exchanges. You will be taught what really matters and what Bitcoin really is. Swan Bitcoin has basically the cleanest onboarding experience, and anybody who listened to their CEO, Corey, and their team actually didn't lose any money in Celsius or Luna because for months they were warning of the risk. And that alone is worth at least getting subscribed to Swan Bitcoin to like their newsletter or just getting their updates, because it literally might save you a ridiculous amount of money. It has for a lot of people. And Swan Private is the top tier service onboarding that'll get you oriented, that'll show you how to hold your keys, I'll walk you through a hardware wallet. It gives you direct access to the team. You can ask any questions or have any worries because Bitcoin can be unfamiliar. You literally have competent people to answer your questions that aren't trying to shill you tokenized bananas and $5,000 JPEGs. You will get real money, a simple low-cost savings plan, the best onboarding experience, an insanely knowledgeable team, and a company that wants to build a long-term relationship. There's a reason I've been using them since they were around. Go to swanbitcoin.com/guy. That is my link. You'll see my pretty face and a really fun quote that I like at the top of the page. And there may be some goodies for you on the other side of it. Check it out, swanbitcoin.com/guy. Let's jump back in. The monetization of other assets. Although most of us today are used to it, fiat currency has been a polarizing and inherently political subject ever since the world went onto this petrodollar standard 5 decades ago. Mainstream media and economists, however, quickly adopted it as canon and rather unquestionable. For decades now, it has been the case that if someone thinks money shouldn't be fiat currency, they're kind of considered a kook and not taken seriously. This kind of vibe. Insert the "but it was aliens" meme. But when you step back and think about it from first principles, this period in history is really unusual. It's a historical aberration. And like a fish in water doesn't even notice the water, the monetary system we operate with now seems totally normal to us. Never before, in thousands of years of human history, has the entire world been using a money that has no resource cost or constraint. It's an experiment, in other words, and we're 5 decades into it. Many would consider it a good experiment, while others consider it a bad one. But it's not as though it is inevitable, or the only possible outcome from here. It's simply what we have now, and who knows what things will look like in another 5 decades. To put it into perspective, this international monetary system based around centrally managed fiat currency is only 16 years older than me. My father was 36 when the US went off the gold standard. When I grew up, after a period of financial hardship, I began collecting gold and silver coins as a kid. My father gave me silver coins as savings each year. The Swiss dropped their gold standard when I was 12 years old, which was 6 years after Amazon was founded, and 3 years before Tesla was founded. The fiat and petrodollar standard is only 4 times older than Bitcoin, and only 2 times older than the first internet browser. That's pretty recent when you think about it like that. Ever since the world has been on the fiat and petrodollar standard, debt as a percentage of GDP has skyrocketed to record levels and seems to be getting unstable. Considering where we are in the long-term debt cycle, investors would do well to be creative with how they envision the future. Don't take the past 40 to 50 years for granted and assume that's how it will always be, whether for money or anything else. We don't know what money will look like 50 years from now. The last time we were in a similar debt and monetary policy situation was the 1930s and 40s, where currency devaluations and war occurred. That doesn't mean those things have to happen, but basically, we're in a very macro-heavy environment where structural currency changes tend to occur. One of the results of fiat currency, especially towards the later stages of this 5-decade experiment since the 1970s, is that more people have begun to treat cash like a hot potato. We instinctively monetize other things, like art, stocks, home equity, or gold. The ratio of home prices to median income has gone up a lot, as well as the ratio of the S&P 500 to median income, or a top-notch piece of art to median income. This chart shows the loss of purchasing power of the US dollar since the Coinage Act of 1792, which is when the US dollar and the US mint were created. So with this chart, it basically just shows that the inflation rate, the estimated value of a dollar, was almost perfectly stable with minor fluctuations all the way until about 1913 when the Federal Reserve was created, and then peaked and found a higher plateau before just kind of skyrocketing in 1971. From there on out, it's just a constant and stable decline. It currently takes nearly $3,000 to have as much purchasing power as $100 bought in 1792. From 1792 to 1913, the dollar's purchasing power oscillated mildly around the same value, with over 120 years of relative stability. From 1913 onward, the policy changed and the dollar has been in perpetual decline, especially after it completely dropped the gold peg in 1971, and is actually worse today than during most of this 1971 to 2022 fiat petrodollar period, because interest rates aren't keeping up with inflation rates anymore. The fiat system is getting less stable due to so much debt being in the system. which disallows policymakers from raising interest rates higher than the prevailing inflation rate. Basically, for lack of good money in this fiat currency petrodollar era, especially in the post-2009 era with interest rates below inflation rates, we monetize other things with higher stock-to-flow ratios and treat them as stores of value. In China, consumers aggressively monetize real estate. It became normal for families to own multiple homes. In the United States, consumers aggressively monetize stocks. We plow a percentage of each paycheck into broad equity indices without analyzing companies or doing any sort of due diligence, treating that basket of stocks as simply a better store of value than cash, regardless of what is inside. We can ask, for example, would we rather own dollars that went from $10 trillion in quantity 10 years ago to $22 trillion today and pay basically no yield to own them, or Apple shares that went from 26 million shares 10 years ago to 16 million shares today and also pay basically no yield to own it? Is the dollar better money? Or is a diverse collection of fungible corporate shares better money when it comes to storing value with a 5+ year time horizon? This monetization of non-money securities and property opens us up to more volatility, more leverage, less liquidity, less fungibility, and more taxable events. Basically, rather than investments being special things we make with careful consideration, we shovel most of our free capital into hundreds of index investments that we don't even analyze, since who would hold currency for any significant length of time? Fungible pieces of corporations become our money, at least for the store of value portion of what money is, in large part because they pay higher earnings and dividend yields than bank or bond yields, and many of them decrease in quantity, deflationary, rather than constantly increase in quantity. Some technologists like Jeff Booth have argued that this system of perpetual currency debasement has a negative impact on the environment because it encourages us to spend and consume on short-sighted depreciating trinkets and malinvestment more than we would if our money appreciated in value over time like it used to. With appreciating money, we would be more selective with our purchases. Proponents of the fiat system argue that it smooths out economic downturns and allows for counter-cyclical investment and stimulus. By having a flexible monetary base, policymakers can increase or decrease the supply of money in order to provide a balancing force against credit cycles and industrial output capacity. In exchange for a persistently declining value of currency, we get a more stable currency on a year-to-year basis. In addition, proponents of the system also argue that the system encourages more consumption, and consider that to be a good thing because it keeps GDP up. By keeping people on a constant treadmill of currency debasement, it forces them to spend and invest rather than to save. If people begin to save, these policymakers often view it as hoarding or a global savings glut and consider it to be a problem. Monetary policy is then adjusted to convince people to save less, spend more, and borrow more. From a developing market standpoint, the fiat petrodollar standard contributes to massive booms and busts because a lot of their debt is denominated in dollars, and that debt fluctuates wildly in strength depending on the actions of U.S. policymakers. Developing countries are often forced to tighten their monetary policy during a recession in order to defend their currency. And thus, while the U.S. gets to provide counter-cyclical support for its own economy, developing countries are forced to be pro-cyclical, contributing to a vicious cycle in their economies during recessions. In this view, the fiat petrodollar system can be considered a form of neocolonialism. We push most of the cost of the system out into developing countries in order to maximize the stability for the developed world. Overall, the fiat system is showing more instability lately, and investors have to navigate a challenging environment of structurally negative inflation-adjusted cash and bond yields, along with many high asset valuations in equities and real estate. Sovereign international reserves. As countries accumulate trade surpluses, they keep those gains in sovereign international reserves. This represents the pool of assets that a country's central bank can draw upon to defend the country's currency if needed. The more reserves a country has relative to its GDP and money supply, the more defense it has against a meltdown in its fiat currency. The country can sell these reserves and buy back its own currency to support its currency per unit value. The currency may not be backed up by gold at a redeemable rate, but it's backed up by diverse assets as needed if it starts to rapidly lose value. The world collectively has about 15 trillion US dollar equivalents worth of official sovereign reserves. Less than 2.5 trillion of that is gold, with more than 12.5 trillion held as fiat reserves, dollars, euros, yen, francs, etc. Fiat reserves consist of government bonds and bank deposits, and can be easily frozen by the countries that issue them. In addition, many gold holdings are not held within the country, but instead are held in New York or London on their behalf. Thus, the vast majority of sovereign official reserves are permissioned assets rather than permissionless assets. They are non-sovereign, able to be frozen by foreign nations. War crystallizes this fact. In February 2022, Russia invaded Ukraine. Russia had 630 billion US dollar equivalents of sovereign international reserves prior to the war, representing decades of accumulated trade surpluses as sovereign savings to underpin their currency. Of this 630 billion, 130 billion consisted of gold, and the other 500 billion consisted of fiat currency and bonds. Of that 500 billion, maybe 70 to 80 billion consisted of Chinese fiat assets, and the other 400 plus billion consisted of European and other fiat assets. Europe subsequently froze that $400 billion in Russian fiat assets in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which is equivalent to over 20% of Russian GDP and over 5 years of Russian military spending, an utterly massive economic confiscation. Russia is currently in a financial crisis, and it remains to be seen if they can exert enough commodity or military pressure to have their reserves unfrozen. Some could argue that it's a good thing that countries hold their reserves in each other's assets and thus can be frozen. Along with trade sanctions, this practice gives countries another lever with which to control each other's behavior away from extremes, such as war. We're all interdependent to one degree or another anyway. But from a pragmatic point of view, countries tend to want to reduce their vulnerabilities and external risks where possible, and that can include minimizing the ability of their stored-up central bank reserves to be confiscated or frozen by other countries. I began writing this long-form article months ago, in late 2021. Things have accelerated since then, and for example, the Wall Street Journal ran an article in early March 2022 called, quote, "If Russian currency reserves aren't really money, the world is in for a shock." Here's the opening paragraph. Quote, "What is money is a question that economists have pondered for centuries, but the blocking of Russia's central bank reserves has revived its relevance for the world's biggest nations, particularly China. In a world in which accumulating foreign assets is seen as risky, military and economic blocks are set to drift farther apart." What is money? Well, the answer to that question ties into the difference between currency and money. Currency is some other entity's liability, and they can choose whether or not to honor that particular liability. Money is something that is intrinsically valuable in its own right to other entities, and that has no counterparty risk if you custody it yourself, although it may have pricing risk related to supply and demand. In other words, Russia's gold is money. Their FX reserves are currency. The same is true for other countries. Fiat currency and government bonds have no intrinsic value. They represent indirect claims of value that can be blocked and confiscated. Gold has value. It's sufficiently fungible, and due to its physical properties, various entities would accept gold at the current market value. It can be self-custodied, and no external nation can shut it off. Currency acts like money most of the time, until one day it doesn't. Fiat summarized. Overall, the key feature or bug of fiat currency, depending on how you look at it, is its flexible supply and its ability to be diluted. It allows governments to spend more than they tax by diluting people's existing holdings. With this feature, it can be used to re-liquefy seized-up financial situations and stimulate an economy in a counter-cyclical way. In addition, its volatility can be minimized compared to commodity monies most of the time through active management, in exchange for ensuring gradual devaluation over time. When things go wrong, however, fiat currency can lose value explosively. Fiat currency tends to incentivize running bigger deficits, since spending doesn't necessarily need to be taxed for, and generally requires some degree of hard or soft coercion in order to get people to use it over harder monies, although that coercion is often rather invisible to most people most of the time, until things go wrong. And its ability to be diluted can allow for longer wars, selective bailouts for influential groups, and other forms of government spending that aren't always transparent to citizens. Digital assets. All right, we're going to pause right there. This will conclude part two of What is Money Anyway? And we will get into digital assets, Bitcoin, everything that's going on, and the shift to a digital sovereign asset, or a sovereignly held, something that can, it is not a counterparty risk. Tomorrow she concludes this one really well, and there's some really fun stuff to dive into. I have saved a ton of notes on this, but I got a lot of other recording to do, and I want to make sure that I get part three out this part three and a couple of other episodes out this week. I want to have a good week here, so we're actually going to close this out. I have a ton of notes, like I said, so we are going to do a follow-up guys take where I just kind of rant through all of this stuff and talk about fiat money and then juxtapose Bitcoin and why it's so important in the context of historical, this largely unprecedented place we find ourselves in monetary history. One of the biggest, like the best takeaways, I think, from this section of the piece is the recognition of how young, how out of the ordinary and experimental our purely fiat global system really is, and all of the negative dynamics that we just take this thing for granted because it's here and it's the way things are being done, without looking at the horrible trend of the last 50 to 60 years and where it has led us. And we're coming to terms with what the cost of this system truly is. And unfortunately, it looks like it's going to be an explosive loss rather than a continually gradual one. But I don't know, honestly, don't even know which is better. You rip the Band-Aid off, or you just be in perpetual poverty and pain. I don't know. It's horrible either way because of the debts that have been built up explicitly because of fiat. And it's funny, you can argue, you can make the case for the dangers and the poisons of fiat money using the proponent's own arguments. They basically explain the in a positive sounding light all of the horrible negative outcomes of fiat, like the cognitive dissonance of blaming consumerism and frivolous wasting of money on anything, you know, in the checkout aisle and buying everything on credit and not caring or thinking deeply about what you're purchasing. Immediately after aggressively and endlessly promoting fiat as a tool to force people to spend money they don't need to spend, to force people to go more into debt and waste their savings. To hold both of those beliefs at the same time requires a potent amount of cognitive dissonance. And we will get into all of this stuff with this literal, I have pages and pages of notes from going through this thing. It's ridiculous. So, and I know I will have a lot more tomorrow. I've already read through the last part of this piece, and it's going to be good. It's going to be really good. So we'll do a guys take to follow up with this. And then I have a handful of really good Bitcoin Magazine articles actually, that I'm a little bit backlogged on. And I wanna ramp this up. It's time to kick this sucker back into gear. So stay subscribed. We have got a lot of great reads, a lot of great episodes coming. And I've even got two interviews that I've been sitting on for a little while that I haven't even published yet. So stay tuned. Don't forget to subscribe. Follow me on Twitter at TheGuySwan. A huge thank you to Fold, to Swan Bitcoin, and soon to the Cold Card. Cold Card just for having a great product, but soon they will be sponsoring this show as well. Don't forget, you can get a 20% discount on the Fold Card with code BitcoinAudible. 20% is solid. Do not leave that on the table. And check out Swan Bitcoin at my link, swanbitcoin.com/guy. If you are looking for the Bitcoin onboarding experience, there is nothing better than Swan Bitcoin. No noise, no shitcoins, straight to what you need, and the best team in the business. All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening. I will catch you on the next episode of Bitcoin Audible. And until then, everybody, take it easy. You have been listening to Bitcoin Audible, a 111 production.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.